Thank you, Celia. Good evening, everybody. It's good to see you again. So we continue our series in the life of Paul with this fascinating encounter in Athens. Now, I wonder what sort of behaviour really, really upsets you. What does somebody have to do to arouse deep distress right inside you? In particular, what is so beyond the pale that you simply cannot reconcile it to your Christian faith? I think it's all right. There you go. Try that. Technical glitch. Okay. So what is it that sort of really upsets you? Perhaps what you find distressing is to hear Jesus' name taken in vain, is to hear it being used as a swear word. Perhaps you get upset when you see somebody who is being unfaithful to their spouse or their partner, or who's sexually promiscuous. Or maybe you get upset when you see the way that provocative images are used in advertising. Perhaps you get upset when you see parents who are so caught up in their work that they have no time for family life and they miss their children growing up. Or maybe they're so caught up in their children that they don't allow those children to find their own identity. You know, the sort of driven mum and dad who's on the touchline at football, screaming at the referee. Or the dad who insists that son has to do, or daughter has to do, twice as much homework as everybody else because nothing less than A stars will do when it comes to their exams. Maybe what annoys you is a neighbour or a colleague who has a lifestyle that's different from yours. Or a family member who's only got time for themselves and for nobody else. Perhaps you're simply distressed at the way that the world is run. And at the way that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And justice seems to be something that is available only to those who can afford it for whatever reason. I wonder how you respond to the situations around you that make you angry and distressed because somebody's lifestyle or priorities fall short of your idea of God's best for the world. Our reading this evening finds Paul in Athens with a bit of spare time on his hands. He's waiting for Silas and Timothy to catch up with him after escaping a couple of angry crowds in Thessalonica and in Berea earlier in the chapter. And so it seems that Paul did what all good visitors to Athens do, and he got engaged in a spot of sightseeing. And what he saw as he went about the city upset him, because the city was full of idols. And so here was a good monotheistic Jewish Christian, a God-fearing man who believed in the one true God, who had met him on the Damascus Road and who found himself now in the middle of a city with countless gods which seemed to be made of stone or wood or gold or whatever. People seemed to worship whatever they wanted and whoever they wanted, especially if they could carve it out of gold or silver or stone. They worshipped anything and everyone except God. And that distressed Paul. No, in fact, we read that it greatly distressed him. After all, he knew better. He had met the living God and he'd been saved by him. He knew the truth. He had it at his fingertips, ready to give to anybody who needed it, ready to give to anybody who asked about it. And boy, did these people in that city need the truth. So Paul did what any of us would do when we get really, really angry. The veins in his neck stuck out. He turned a funny shade of green and his shirt ripped. And his muscles bulged, ready for action. Right? No, of course not. The Incredible Hulk might be a caricature of the way that we respond when something upsets us, but it doesn't apply to Paul in Athens. So what does he do? Well, firstly, he does what he has done everywhere else he has been, and he visits the synagogue. He goes to the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, who are probably the people who should be the people who are most likely to agree with him. Maybe he's trying to get them on side. Perhaps these people should have known better and need a bit of encouragement or a nudge in the right direction. Or maybe they've become so ingrained in the local culture that it's their last chance before he offers the gospel to the pagan Gentiles in the city. I don't know. Either way, Paul's response is interesting. Despite his enormous distress, he does not overreact. He doesn't rant. He reasons with them. Make a note of that, because we'll return to that later. And then, as well as meeting up with his own people, Paul engages with the locals, verse 17, and whoever else happened to be hanging around in the marketplace. And soon enough, a group of philosophers started to debate with him. Now, apparently, these people called the Epicureans taught that the supreme good is long-term happiness. But by Paul's time, this had sort of morphed into a very sensual way of thinking. Whereas the other philosophers that he bumped into, the Stoics, taught that people should live in harmony with nature, that they should recognize their own self-sufficiency and independence, but suppress their desires. They were two very different schools of thought, one very self-indulgent and the other very sober, but both of them full of pride in their approach. And so as Paul preached the good news about Jesus, about his life and his death and his resurrection, I wonder what the pleasure-seeking Epicureans thought of a Christ who gave himself for others so that we could return to God. And I wonder what the self-sufficient and very serious Stoics thought about the idea of being dependent upon Christ to rescue them, and about the idea that he was Lord over nature to the point of being able to rise again from the dead. We know that these groups of people thought that Paul was advocating foreign gods, and I suppose in a way he was to them. We know that they wanted to hear more, although Luke seems to be somewhat scathing of a community that seems to like spending all its time gossiping about the latest ideas. Nevertheless, having started in the synagogue, having started amongst the fringe members of the community and moved into the marketplace to engage with the locals, Paul is then taken up to a meeting of the Areopagus. This was the community's movers and shakers, if you like, the local council, I suppose. They were the people who had authority in relation to the religion and morals of the people of Athens. Although I've said it's a bit like the local council, I'm not actually sure what the equivalent would be these days. I don't think it would be like speaking to a council meeting, because I don't think we go and sit down and read the papers from cover to cover to see what's been said in those meetings. I don't even think it's like being given a chance to speak in Parliament. Perhaps it's more like speaking on Newsnight or the Andrew Marr show, where there's a lot of people listening. But then how many of us get that opportunity? Perhaps the nearest equivalent for you and me is simply the chance to speak to family and friends and colleagues and neighbours over a cup of coffee or a meal or a pint. And this is where we find the key point in today's message. Because instead of speaking to the Athenians from his own perspective and background, which would have been so easy to do, Paul met the people where they were. Verses 22 and 23, right through to verse 31. The story contrasts really quite sharply with Paul's approach, or with many of the other presentations of the gospel in the book of Acts, like Peter addressing the crowds at Pentecost in Acts 2, or Stephen's speech to the Sanhedrin in Acts 7, or Paul himself in the synagogue at Antioch, all of which introduced the gospel by referring to Israel's history, by referring to the scriptures as he knew them. And it seems that he did that earlier in chapter 17 as well, in Thessalonica and Berea. But here in the Areopagus at Athens, that approach would have been meaningless. Those people didn't identify themselves with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, or with David and Solomon. And so however big a role had this history played in Jesus' story, that wasn't going to resonate with them. Instead, Paul used what the Athenians already knew to point them to God. Despite the fact that their idol worship distressed him greatly, he acknowledged their search for God. Men of Athens, he said, I see that in every way you are very religious. Verse 22. Well, a bit of flattery wasn't going to do any harm, was it? But more than that, instead of dismissing their objects of worship, their idols, he actually used them as the starting point for his message. Verse 23, for as I walked round and looked carefully at your objects of worship, and then comes his masterstroke, he found a way to lead them from their idols, from where they were. Towards the gospel, as I walked around, as I looked at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Now, what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. What a way in. What a way in that he had. Genius. And like all genius, it's so simple, isn't it? And even then, Paul resisted the temptation to go back to what was familiar to him, to go back to a resume of Israel's history. Instead, he continued with what the Athenians knew. He started with what they could see around them, the creation that inspired so much of their religious thinking. And he introduced them to God as creator. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. It was a challenge to their way of thinking, a challenge to their worldview, and at the same point, at the same time, it was an appeal to their philosophical logic and reason. From one man, says Paul, he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth And he determined the exact times and places set for them where they should live. This God that Paul was introducing to them was not only living and personal, he was sovereign, he was king. It was a challenge to their philosophical pride, whether their emphasis was on Epicurean self-gratification or Stoic self-denial. It was saying to them that they were not ultimately in control. God was. And Paul goes on to say, God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. That was a connection with the Stoic philosophers who believed that in living in harmony with nature. And there again was the flattery as he quoted their poets. He was really connecting with them where they were. And that gave him the basis for challenging them with the gospel. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Now I find that really interesting, because here Paul's gospel emphasis is not on the cross, which is what we might expect. It's not on the cross and the forgiveness of sins, but instead it's on the resurrection and the start of a new life. And perhaps that's relevant to a group of people whose idols are based on the creation around them, which they know naturally tends towards death and decay. Perhaps they needed to hear about the hope of new life in Jesus before they heard about the need for forgiveness from sins, which they probably were not yet convinced they'd committed. So what about our culture? What about our response? Well, in our multicultural and cosmopolitan society, we should expect many different responses to the gospel. The example of Paul's ministry in Athens shows that different presentations of the gospel are required to reach different groups. Paul met the Athenians where they were. But the important thing is that whilst he started where they were, he did not end there. He started with their idols and with a sort of nature theology. But he used that situation as a launching point from which to return to his main message. By implication, Christ crucified, but more explicitly, Christ risen. And I wonder whether sometimes in our evangelical fervor to focus rightly on the power of the cross for forgiveness and for reconciliation, I wonder whether we sometimes lose sight of the aspect of the gospel that shows the power of the empty grave to give the hope of a new start in life in a decaying natural world. Because this seems to be Paul's emphasis in speaking in Athens. In a society that knew that the natural order of things was a tendency towards death and decay, speaking of somebody returning to life was a risky strategy. And so we read in verse 32 that when they heard about the resurrection from the dead, some of them sneered. But it was a strategy that had impact, because others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." And at that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Diosinus, a member of the Areopagus, and also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Was it worth the effort? Surely it was, wasn't it? These were movers and shakers. These were influential people who became believers. Now, we don't know very much about them at all. We don't read subsequent letters from Paul to the Athenians that imply that a significant Christian community quickly became established. We don't know what happened next. But the very fact that Luke mentions these people by name invites his early readers to check out the facts with them or with people who knew them. And it adds weight to the validity of this story and to the power of the gospel. In other words, the approach that Paul took in Athens is one that we are called to take, which is to be faithful to Jesus' call to take the gospel into all the world and to make disciples from every nation. There's no way that we can know what the response will be to the things that we say when we share God's love, or to the things that we do. If I tried to second guess that, I'm so bad at reading people's body language that I would get it wrong 9 times out of 10. No. All we're called to do is to be faithful in sharing the gospel through our words and our actions. And we leave the consequences to God, who can do far more than we might ever ask or imagine through his power working in us. This is a key story for us to learn from in 21st century Britain. Paul was speaking to a community that did not relate to his own people's history. Now, some of us were born into a nation where 1 in 5 children attended Sunday school and so knew something about the Christian gospel. Today, we find ourselves living in a nation where just 1 in 25 children attend Sunday school. We find ourselves living in communities where many of our neighbours belong to a variety of different religions. We can no longer present the gospel in ways that our grandparents and our parents did. Paul's example here in Acts 17 shows us that we can be imaginative about how we present it. As we saw earlier, the simple genius in Athens was to find a way to lead the people from where they were, from their idols, to the gospel. Our friends and neighbors might well have a very different way of doing things, one which might even distress us. But our challenge is, how will we meet them where they are? What parts of their situation can we take and use to point them towards God, as Paul did in Athens? One of our courses when I was at Spurgeon's College put a rather posh name to the art of doing this. I think it was Roger Standing's excuse for developing a module that he could teach and enjoy teaching. It was called cultural hermeneutics. But basically, it involves looking at various contemporary aspects of our culture, such as films or TV shows or adverts or the newspapers, and finding ways of making connections with things that we see or read there. such as forgiveness or faithfulness or beauty in creation. Is anybody here a Doctor Who fan? Nobody? Nobody? Nobody saw it last night. If you look on iPlayer, you'll find a discussion between Doctor Who and his archenemy Davros from last night's programme. Davros is the man who created the Daleks. And he was mocking the Doctor by saying that his heart for compassion was his greatest weakness and it will kill you in the end. And the Doctor responds with the profound statement that I wouldn't die of anything else. Does that remind you of anyone? Yeah? The thing is, it's surprisingly easy to find ways to identify gospel themes in the culture around us, even when there's no explicit link to the gospel or to anything to do with Jesus. It's actually easy to find those links, and it's easy to find those links in the lives of the people that we meet. Paul's colleague, the Apostle Peter, describes our response like this. In your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Paul was certainly ready to give an answer. And his answer was based on reason. His reason for hope in Jesus. But in suppressing his distress and in engaging with the Athenians reasonably, he demonstrated how to do this with gentleness and respect. And he provided an example for us to follow. And it's also worth remembering that in coming to a broken world that caused him the most enormous distress, Jesus meets us where we are. He approaches us with gentleness and respect, holding out the offer of God's love for us to respond to. He invites us to follow his example and to continue his presence in the same broken world, suppressing our distress at its godlessness in order to meet others where they are and to hold out the same offer of God's love for them to respond to. Paul did it, and some responded. Amongst all the people who we know, there will be some who, like Diosinus and Damaris, are ready to believe if only someone will meet them where they are, if only someone will lead them gently and respectfully from whatever modern-day so-called idols they may currently have, and move them from there towards the love of God. Amen.